So there you go.
Handed me a dead mic. Thank you. Rainforest Puffy, everybody. Rainforest Puffy. The Puffy's in the house. Okay, this is the Razer Wares. We have a number of freeware tools and stuff that Razer develops in the course of our work, and we never have really gone out and highlighted what it is that we have been doing. And since it's Wares in there with a Z, we wanted to keep with kind of a low-tech theme, so we're not going to be using PowerPoint. The idea for this was inspired from Hobbit. Yes, go ahead, applaud for that. The idea for this was inspired by Hobbit, who's did a presentation entirely in ASCII, so I'm just going to less the file, and here we go. Oh boy, that was so worth it, you know, to do that. It really was. It really was. So there we have it. Interestingly, I ported the entire ASCII presentation into PowerPoint so they could get printed in your things, okay? I did, I swear. Anyway. Okay, specifically... yeah, no, page down. I know, it's cool. I can even page up and go back to the first screen. Okay, so now all your security problems are solved. All right. Both Todd and I are analysts for Razer. The Razer team essentially is kind of an R&D kind of group. We do a lot of research. We write advisories. We're a full disclosure group. We do research papers. These things get put out on the Razer website. For business purposes, a lot of our stuff, most of our stuff, funnels right back into MindView products. But a lot of times, a lot of the cutting edge kind of stuff that ends up in MindView products is coming from some of the freeware stuff that we're going to be showing you here today. In the course of doing these advisories and these research papers, a lot of times we have to throw code together to prove not only to ourselves but to our other teammates that we're actually kind of on track. And a number of these tools have made it out onto the website, and which you're free to download and use. We think they have wondrous uses. This is a list of what we have out there. The only one that is currently not out there on the website is the top one there under the Windows one. That's going to be going up here next week, that Todd's going to be showing. That's Hashpipe. Every one of these you can download. They're all free. And a lot of them have some fairly interesting features and whatnot. Let's see, Zombie Zapper is available on both. If we're all familiar with the whole DDoS thing that went on in February 2000, where we couldn't buy books on Amazon for an hour. Ooh, so you know, we got this tool here, and to kind of tell those zombies to shut up and whatnot. Let's see some of the other interesting ones. ICMP Enum does enumeration using not just Echo, instead of just in the Echo sweeps, but also info packets and. Also, the timestamp, there we go, timestamp packets to do enumerations. See some other interesting ones, dspoof, where we go and check the real TTL. That way you can tell if you've got a packet that you received in and you think it might be spoofed. First thing you can do is check the TTL against the real source. And if they don't match, then you've got something coming from a spoof packet. And so on. There's some other tools that... that we have for Windows that are fairly interesting. One of my favorites is the S-Trace for NT. I'm sure some of the Unix people, they know what S-Trace is. I think they would just absolutely go nuts over the NT one, because you actually go through there and see all these processes that work. And of course, you know, the PWDump2, LSADump2, those are like standard type things. I don't want to steal any of Todd's thunders. He's going to kind of combine some, talk about a lot of these tools here in the later half. The one that I'm going to cover... For right now, where we've actually got some new stuff that we think is pretty interesting, is Vlad the Scanner. And how this started is Sans came up with this top 10 list, where he says, okay, we're going to take the top 10 items, we're going to go through and we're going to create this freeware scanner that everyone can go check those top 10 items. And we had the thing working on both Unix and Windows. The Windows iffy, but it did work. It worked really well on the Unix side. The things that were interesting about it, which are still interesting about it, in my opinion, the CGI scanner. It's database driven. Now the database is fairly simple. It's simply a text file with specific fields, and I'll show you this data structure here in a second. And that's one of those things where this is something that ended up being in the BindView's Hacker Shield or BV Control for Internet Security is the real name for it now. That's the kind of thing where this stuff gets actually put into real products. The other interesting thing with Vlad the Scanner, which I'm not going to demo because it takes too long, but it is extremely interesting, and I encourage you to look at it, is the multi-protocol password cracker. So I can throw dictionaries at FTP, SNMP, if I want to, you know, try to get the figure out what the community string is. It'll do SSH and a number of other things. And of course, it obviously requires you have all these clients loaded on your system to go ahead and run. But it is really, really cool. It's really, really neat and fairly unique. The final thing, which is the thing that I really want to show you guys, we have, because, you know, if we're doing, you know, low tech and mooring through a file, then we got to have, to keep up with that where's thing, we have to have some zero day. So the, and this really isn't real zero day, but it's just new, so you're just going to have to bear with me on that. This banner checker that we have, and basically the code in it actually is called Banner Eater. And what it does is it grabs banners and then checks in its database, which we're going to be adding to extensively, and says, okay, well, this banner, because it's send mail 8.8.4, that's a vulnerable send mail, or, you know, because it's, you know, IMAP version blah blah blah, then that's a vulnerable piece of it's a vulnerable piece of code running on that system. Okay, so that also, I think, eventually is going to work itself into the BindView product line, because it's a very fun approach where we can, you know, rapidly, and not just us, you guys as well, can create these database entries, particularly if you have custom applications too, and or custom things that you want to check for yourselves that we're not checking for. Then you can go ahead and very simply update these things. The Vlad database formats. The CGI database, I'm going to go through these kind of quick, and then I'm going to show you what they look like. First off, we have a title, so we know what it is. A description. The description is simply a pointer to a text file located in a subdirectory, so that when it finds it, it just simply basically cats out the file and says, okay, here's your description of it. if we can get some water up here, that would be most excellent. The platform, specifically, if you've done any type of CGI scanning, it makes sense. RFP started this with Whisker and whatnot. Well, you check to see what the platform is, so you don't send all your Unix things into the system you've identified as IIS. That doesn't make any sense. So we put in the platform. Thank you. And we list a severity, you know, low, medium, and high, so we know what we're talking about here. The root that we have there, that's going to be kind of off the target. Obviously, we're talking about port 80. This is, the root is going to be like, say, CGI-bin, or maybe it's found in scripts if it's maybe an IIS thing, something along those lines. So we put that in there. The query type, whether we're going to use a get or we're going to use a head to pull that information back. And we have what we call the test query and the real query. A lot of times we don't need this, but we found it often kind of handy. If you're querying for a file, and you get back, let's say, a 500 return from the web server, and on the test query, you get back a 404. And that means that I probably do have the file there. It's not just looking to see if I got a 200 return code on my web query. So that's the reason in there. And also because we can brand our test query, usually we're looking for something with the word Hacker Shield in it, so that kind of makes it obvious if someone's, you know, checking your web server and they're looking for all these Hacker Shield files, hackershield.dll, and all these things that don't exist on your web server. That's, you know, so we got some type of fingerprint there. Let me show you. I'm going to turn this off real quick so I can jump over here. I forgot to set this up. Hold on a sec. Okay, that shows you what these entries actually look like in the database. As you can tell, this is just a text file, is all this is. So it's very easy to put these things in here. Title, description, platform. And it gets pretty obvious. Where we've got root, where it's blank there, up on that top one there, basically I've got a list within the CGI engine that runs that says, okay, I'm going to look for common ones like CGI-bin, you know, CGI. It's going to try to find those ahead of time, build up a list of what it sees as places where these things might live, common places where these things might live. And then it's going to plug those in and try the ones that it finds. That way you're not looking for something in CGI bin if the server doesn't have CGI bin even there. That's kind of the whole idea. Why waste your time with that? And so you can see what some of these look like. There's some Unix ones. I'll go down through here and we'll find a... Okay, there's one right there up at the top for Windows. So you can kind of see there that you know, even though we find that for some odd reason in CGI bin there. So you get the idea of what we're looking at for this particular database. It's real easy to put together. I would run through and show you a demo of it, but the thing is we did this last year. We introduced this thing last year and just roughly talked about it. I encourage you to go take a look at it, mainly because I want to show you some other stuff. The banner eater, the fun thing about this is the same type of stuff here. You know, title, description, which basically goes out and casts out a file that we've got in a subdirectory. Platform, the port that you're looking at, severity, the type of comparison we're doing, and then the banner that we're trying to grab itself. And I think that'll become obvious if I just jump over here and show you what I'm talking about. Okay, we got one right there. The first one there, below all the commented stuff, where it's got title, description, platform, etc. Title: old sendmail 4.x. Okay, if it finds that and it looks what it's looking for in the banner here, specifically is sendmail 4. And what'll happen is if we compare it with a partial, we'll grab the whole banner, but all we're doing is we're looking for a substring. Since we're doing a parcel search to see if sendmail 4 is anywhere in there, and it's on port 25. And since we were so infamously clever in our naming of the platform field there, actually it's the first two characters that count. NO stands for non-Windows, and so you get to play and spell it all kinds of fun ways. Because, you know, hey, we're not using PowerPoint, so why spell it correctly? And so that's basically how all this works. I got something. Something else is now working over there. So, not the monitor. If someone could get that screen working, I think it just needs to be. This is the one here. This needs to get working. There's probably a standby button that just needs to be hit, and then we'll be okay. Step on top. Anyway, someone can do that, and then I'll... Yes, Frank will get it. He's very... I'm sorry. Some guy I don't know will be taking care of that. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to run through. We've got several computers hooked up into a hub. And by the way, it pays to bring a spare hub. Okay? And it pays to bring spare cables, because that's what we were doing a while ago. I was just like, hey, this cable worked last night in the hotel room. So give me a second here and let me get this going. Some guy I don't know. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Run it. I'm not going to do the CGI or RDS scan. I'm not going to do the password scan. What I am going to do by running Vlad without those, make this whole thing go a lot quicker, because it does take a while. Like I said, this is kind of more of a proof of concept tool. You can wrap scripts around Vlad and use it on a large scale, but I don't recommend doing that, because it's not meant for that kind of thing. It is more proof of concept. But it is kind of cool and neat to run. What I need to do is I need to do what my buddy George does, and that's get all those commands all ready and then just paste them in from a file and be very impressive. But okay, I scanned that. One of the first, it spotted a couple of things. I should probably moor that out. But yeah, you know, like it spotted that it's got an RPC type problem on there. It spit out the text file, spit out a little bit of other extra stuff. The RPC scanner that was in the first Vlad has been completely rewritten from scratch, and basically this gets invoked in. Let me run it in verbose here with a couple of extra options, and you can, like I said, you can look through the source code and see what all this stuff is doing and play with this. So it finds that it's got something there that it spotted. It saw that 111's open. There's actually a remote root for 111 on certain platforms. It's a little old, but it is in fact out there. So we've got information out there that points you to the right spot and everything. I do have an old version of SendMail running on that box as well. I'm going to invoke this without going through the main part of I can't remember all the options here. Hold on. So I want to show you what this looks like once we go through. By the way, I'm doing my stuff first because Todd's is, I think, a lot more cool. I think you're going to enjoy that. It is. I know he's over there shaking his head now. Okay, so it loads up the stuff in the database. We got some kind of error, because what we're doing is some of the research that Ophir Arkin did with ICMP. We're sending out an ICMP echo packet to try to determine if the OS is Windows or not, and that kind of simplifies what we're going to throw at the box. So we got some kind of error because I've got ICMP stuff turned off on this box and didn't turn it back on. But nonetheless, it finds out there that we've got an old version of SendMail, 8.9 dot something. Got CVE entries, details about possible problems with the 8.9 suite of bugs. And of course, this is the one that is so ever important. Upgrade to the latest SendMail. This is the thing that people hate whenever they interview, well, people in Razor and other people, that they say, what is the biggest thing with computer security? What's the number one thing that people should do, and you know, what are they should be most worried about? Patching your systems, upgrade. So it's kind of funny that all the SendMail ones, they all say, upgrade to the latest version. That makes sense. Some of the older ones, like the ancient ones, say, you're probably going to update your whole OS, because the SendMail isn't even going to work on that. But essentially, that's it. See right here, the PingWin is the utility that was written, and specifically gives some information there. And These tools, by the way, Vlad, there's a lot of people contributed to that. I helped conceptualize some of it. I wrote some of it, but then other people wrote portions of it as well, and it's all been thrown together by various members on the team. I think the one I cringed over the most was when Mikhail Zalewski wrote the Banner Eater. I just kind of outlined it in concept, went to lunch, I got back, he had a working prototype, which really just, oh man, God, why is he... It just killed me that he completed it so quickly. See, we're doing good on time. That's what I have for the Vlad demo. Todd, you want to fly blind? He doesn't have the local screen here.
Testing. Hello. Yeah. Well, we'll see how this works. So the new utility we have it releasing is called HashPipe. It's a combination of a couple of older utilities, PWDump2 and LSADump2, and it adds the ability that it can now dump the cache passwords that are stored on a workstation. As you probably know, Windows will store by default the last 10 logons on the box. In case you don't have your domain controller available, or you're traveling with a laptop or something like that, so it will it'll be able to dump those as well. I just wanted to add that I have Mark to thank for the wonderful name. I was going to call something like Dumpy, and he came up with a nice name like HashPipe. So the demo, which I'll try and do here. It takes different options, like minus one will do the first thing, which is PWDump2. -2 does the LSADump2 part of it, and -3 will do the dumping of cache passwords. If you don't give any options at all, it just does all three at once, just figuring you probably want that. Excuse me? Yeah, I tried to Alt-Enter, but... there it goes. Good. Is that better? Okay.
Remember, he's doing this blind. He's looking at the same screen you are. Don't try this at home.
Is that any better? Well, I'll get one more attempt here.
There we go.
Hi. I'm not much of a GUI person. So that's the PWDump2 part of the things. I don't have very many accounts defined on this machine. Just a test user there. It's pretty standard. You just take this and give it to Loftcrack or something like that. You can also use the passwords or the hashes directly if you have a utility to do that. I'm not aware of one that's publicly available, but you can do that. Actually, I don't. It's on the list of things to do, but there's a lot of things on that list. So. The second thing, of course, is the LSA dump, which dumps all the secrets. Typically, you'll find things like service account passwords in there. I just put one in here so you would see one. One of the things in here, which is somewhat interesting, is this NL $KM. What this is a key which is used to encrypt the cached things we're going to be dumping later. So in order to do that, you have to pull this key out of there, then use it to decrypt the other things, and then you get finally the hashes at the end of it. So this is the third thing. This laptop is actually a member of a domain back in my house, and I had an account on that domain called Taz, and of course it's cached on this laptop so that I can use it on the road. But what this hash here is that it's not the normal NT hash that you're probably used to seeing. It used to be in NT4 up until I think Service Pack 4. They just stored the direct NT hash and LM hash right in the cache. You could easily get it. It's actually stored in the LSA secrets, I believe. They realized that that wasn't a very good thing to do, so they've changed it now. It's actually MD4 of your password plus your username. So it actually depends on your username. The thing you can do with this, of course, is crack it, which I have a program to do also. It's just proof of concept, so it's not really that fast. But if your password's in a dictionary, of course, you get it right away. Of course, my password is foobar. Now, one of the things that's interesting about being able to do this is that you can use this to pretty much attack the encrypting file system on Windows 2000. Because the typical scenario where it's supposed to be useful is you've got a laptop, you travel with it, you use a domain account, and in order to access your encrypted files, you have to log in with that user. You typically are supposed to take the default recovery account, export their private key so the admin can't get to your encrypted files, and then only the user should be able to get to them. And that's true, but all the user has to do to get to the encrypted files is type in his password. So what I'll do now is show an example of how you would do that. If you say somebody had gotten a hold of my laptop and I had some encrypted files and they wanted to read them, what would they do? Well, we'll show you that now. The first thing is they have to log in as administrator. If you don't know the admin password, then of course you just change it using the offline NT password changing disk. Which, if you're not familiar with it, it's a utility written by some, I think, Peter Nordahl. I'm probably butchering his name, I apologize. And he makes it available on his website, and I'll show you that now. You just boot off of it, and you end up, you can change anybody's password, including the administrators. There's a question, does it work under SP1 on Windows 2000? I think this laptop is actually Service Pack 1. I haven't kept track, but I would expect that it does. I'm not 100% certain. Unfortunately, this may actually take a little bit. One of the ways you prevent this kind of an attack of being able to change the admin password is by using syskey. You'll note that if you go to read some of Microsoft's papers on EFS, they strongly recommend that you use one of the more secure settings for syskey. By default in Windows 2000, it's enabled, but it's only in the obfuscation mode, which means you can just boot your laptop anyway. They recommend either using a boot floppy or using a password for the syskey part of it. Unfortunately, it looks like the bottom of this is going to be cut off, which is... but if you do that, then you won't be able to boot the machine. You can still use this utility to change the administrator password, but you won't then be able to boot the machine. So it is some additional security. Although the problem is that with, like, for instance, the boot floppy scenario, if it's a laptop somebody's traveling with, they're almost certainly going to have their boot floppy right in with the laptop. And the other case is that you configure syskey to use a password that you type in at boot time. in that case, you've got basically another password to crack. I haven't written something to do that, but it's certainly possible. Okay, so maybe we should just assume that I've changed it at this point because I can only see what's up there and the prompt is not showing. How do you see that? Oh, it's actually here also. So it asks if you want to load SCSI drivers. I don't need any of those. After that, you can pretty much just take all the defaults. It has an option in it to disable SysKey, which doesn't really work very well, so he recommends not doing it, and it's not really necessary because you can change the passwords without disabling SysKey. So you just say no at this point, which is also the default. And I'll just change the password to be foo or something. At this point, it asks you several times if you want to continue because in theory it's a little dangerous, but it's always worked for me. Okay, so that's done, and we boot again. Yay, Windows. While this is going, I might as well talk a little bit about basically what this is showing is the only security that EFS will really give you, at least in this scenario, is it's only as strong as your password is. If you have a very strong password that's quite hard to crack, then EFS may actually buy you something. If your password is something that's easily cracked or is in a dictionary or something, then EFS, at least on a laptop in this scenario, doesn't really get you a whole lot. In my testing at home, my unoptimized cracker got through basically all six length alphanumeric passwords in about a little over a day on a P3500. So if you optimize and extrapolate, you can probably do at least a million or so attempts a second. So your password needs to be fairly long. This is actually also demonstrating another interesting thing that there's some conventional wisdom, hopefully it's not as conventional anymore, that on Windows there's really no point in having a longer than 7-character password. For this scenario, that's absolutely not true, because the reason that's true or was true in the past is that it's all dependent on your LM hash, and there's no LM hash in this scenario, so all you have to work with is the NT hash, so the longer your password is, the harder it will be to crack. So at this point, just log in with password foo, of course. I tried to find volume on this laptop and couldn't. My apologies. So we've already seen this, but you run this through a cracker at this point. You know that the password we've seen before is foobar for that user. So I have a file in another directory, which is encrypted. If you can see access is denied, I'm logged in as administrator. And everyone has full control, so you can't read it because it's encrypted. But we cracked the user's password, so we just log out and log back in with that user's password. Excuse me? The file is encrypted with EFS, yeah. But you log in as the user, and it nicely decrypts it for you. and there it is. That's basically what Hashpipe does. Aside from EFS, you can just crack people's passwords as well with yet another password hash. Does anybody know how we're doing on time?
We're doing pretty good. We're going to take some questions or something.
Yeah, so we'll open the floor for questions at this point about any of this stuff. The question is, how difficult is it to go directly for the EFS file? I actually don't know. I think I've read a little bit. I'm not really that much of an expert on EFS. I think they're using something like 128-bit DESX or something like that. But the only thing that matters really is that you don't have to, if at least in this scenario. As long as the encryption is somewhat decent, you go for an easier attack. He's asking for a clarification with it. We're not actually breaking EFS in the sense of using or decrypting the files. We're more or less attacking the user's password and using that to let the system decrypt it with EFS for us. And yeah, that's correct. So if your password is, say, 14 characters and it's got all these extra pound sign, dollar sign, upper, lower case, this probably won't work, at least not in a reasonable amount of time. The question is if you could explain how Zombie Zapper works, and I'll give that one to Mark.
Okay, first off, I didn't name the thing, okay? I want that right up front. I didn't name it. I named Hashpipe. That's a cool name, okay? basically, the way Zombie Zapper works is typically what you have is these zombie demons that are running on compromised boxes that are going to be actually sending out the flood. They do respond to remote commands, and since a lot of what was going on, particularly in the first half of year 2000, was that a lot of these were appearing and they were being used with their default passwords. And people were shoving these things out there, so every time we knew a default password, so to speak, which was, if I send in this certain type of packet, I can tell the zombie that's on that system to stop flooding the target. And so that's what Zombie Zapper did, was it essentially would pretend to be the attacker sending in the commands to shut that zombie down. We had to do a little bit of refinement. We had a great time testing it, too, by the way. No one in the office got anything done because we're flooding the network and everything. But when you're... You can't just send one packet because there's a whole flood of stuff coming in. So we found, well, you have to send basically a whole flood of these out there, and hopefully one gets through and then shuts it down. And that's roughly the concept of how Zombie Zapper works. And there are two versions, but there's a command line one for Unix and then a nice GUI one for the non-Unix people in the room. That we put together, and that's essentially how that works.
So do you have to guess the password?
No, it assumes that it's the default password. Now, normally, I'm trying to think of some of these off the top of my head. Like on some of them, the command to tell the daemon to shut down was to send an ICMP echo packet with a certain ICMP ID in the packet, and that was in fact the quote password to shut it down. And so it's things like that. Now, of course, anyone that had any intelligence would change some of these things, and we realized that we would be creating essentially our own denial of service attack ourselves if we allowed it to, say, brute force try to shut something down, particularly when you didn't know what the demon was. So we just assumed, okay, we'll try one of these four and then try it. I mean, it did work, and it was, I don't necessarily think it was too controversial because we're throwing packets back. We are trying to protect ourselves from the network. The only odd thing, we had one that we weren't sure it would forge from the Class C, and we had to send the packets to every node on the Class C, which was, but just to try to make sure we hit it or something like that, or just send it somewhere on that Class C to try to find it. But that's basically it. Question is, can you do anything to fingerprint the zombies? Yeah, you could, and oftentimes we didn't build that into Zombie Zapper. It wasn't something that just sits there passively and looks and says, you know, I think that flood coming in is from TFN2K. So I'm going to do, or from Trinu or whatever. It didn't do that and say, okay, so I'm going to send this in response. It assumed that you did some type of analysis and could specify, I think it may be this. Actually, I think the default was it just sent everything. Everything that it knew about. There's a question. Someone at the very back had their hands up. Yes.
The question is, if I were to do EFS, how would I do it better? I actually haven't looked at EFS that much in depth. Somebody suggested this attack to us. He doesn't want credit for it, so I just didn't thank him anonymously. But essentially, there's nothing really to be done about this. You can make it somewhat harder to crack the passwords. You can increase the work factor. But the bottom line is, if all your user has to do to access his encrypted files is supply his password, then you're going to be able to do something like this, no matter what you've done. Smart cards may be a way to around this. I'm not a smart card expert either, but they may change things. But if all you have to do to get to your files is type your password, there's always going to be enough information on the machine to brute force the password. So there's not a lot that you can do that's to improve it.
Any other questions? That can be about anything, anything at all. Right there.
It wasn't the case where you have multiple entity domain names flooded on the same box. When you dump the cache, do you also try to send the user ID back to the hash?
The question is, if you have multiple domains, do you get the SID back? No, it doesn't try and get the SID. The information that it stores in the cache area is basically, actually probably does have the SID there, but you don't need it to crack the password, so I haven't bothered to try and get it out. I think that you could. It's probably in there along with their groups that they're members of and so forth, so that when they log on without the domain controller, they can get the proper security token. I think the information's there, but Hashpipe doesn't bother to get it.
Right there.
You can wrap the username in the password. Is there a way to, and you have to encrypt the file, is there a way to get to the contents of it without actually logging in? Or is there a way to send it for cash?
I think the question is, once you've cracked the user's password from the cache, can you then decrypt the files without actually logging in? Is that the question? I see no reason why not, but it's way more work than just logging in, really. So, the question is that could you then pull encrypted files off of the network and then get them that way? Well, once you've cracked their password, you would just, use your normal SMB sharing and just net use to the machine that the file is on. I think EFS across a network, it doesn't apply, at least not at the moment. The remote machine will always decrypt it before it sends it across the network to the local machine. So I don't know that there's a need to do that there.
One more at the very back there. Question was, have we done any other work such as similar to a D-spoof involving network stuff? No, but we plan on doing more. There's a lot of stuff to be done in that area. As a matter of habit, usually any of the utilities that I write, whether they're really needed or not, the command line Unix utilities, I usually try to give it the ability to spoof packets and whatnot. I mean, I don't know why you D-spoof has the ability when it checks the stuff to spoof packets, that kind of thing. So we're always thinking along those lines. There's one utility that I did that is not related to work. It's more kind of an NMRC thing that was, although portions worked its way into some of LAD, which was I had implemented a version of Ophir Arkin's ICMP OS identification that's on the local network is extremely accurate. And so we've been doing some fun network stuff and everything, nothing that I can hand you on a silver platter and say, oh yeah, we got this other zero day that we didn't get to. I think that's pretty much it. So we want to thank everyone for coming. See you later.
Thank you.